I shall sometimes use another word of my own which is also not English, so I've written it up there too, constated. Well, this is rather a large theme by this time, talking about qualities, and I shall be able to go into everything. What I'll try to do is to introduce to you, with apologies to you two who know it already, introduce to you the notion of the performative utterance pretty much in the way that it was originally introduced, and then proceed to raise some difficulties about it as introduced in this way. Now, these are real difficulties. I don't think they mean that talking about performatives is altogether unprofitable and has led nowhere, far from it. But they are enough to show that the introduction of the performative in as it originally occurred was rather unclear. We've got to clear it up again. Well, this is rather beastly for you. You see, I shall introduce this notion and then raise a lot of difficulties about it and then stop, despite the fact that more is known. But you have to begin at the beginning, and I think it may, I hope, give you something to think about afterwards and set right for yourselves. Well, the performative utterance, the notion of the performative utterance, was introduced by way of contrast with the statement or constative utterance, the report, the declarative utterance, and other names for it, which philosophers have spent so much time on. Of course, philosophers and grammarians have always known that there are other kinds of utterance than the statement, true or false. But they haven't paid very much attention on the whole, or haven't paid any very comprehensive attention to these other kinds of utterance. They have thought that the thing that really mattered and the thing which we could get really clear about was what we're calling the statement or constative utterance, which has this very interesting and special property that it's always either true or false. So, as happens from time to time, people got tired of this, and just as around the turn of this last century, they began to be interested in nonsense rather than falsity, so they also began to be interested in other kinds of utterance than the supposedly straightforward statement. And the performative utterance is one such candidate for attention, as an utterance that just is not meant to be true or false, and in that respect differs entirely from the statement so dear to traditional philosophers. The performative utterance cannot be true or false. Its special function may be described as that of effecting an action. By issuing the utterance, by saying so and so, we do an act. To issue an utterance of this kind is to perform an action, very often an action which cannot be performed at all, or at least cannot be performed with any comparable sort of preciseness by any other means. Sometimes the act concerned can be done in other ways, but generally it can't. Now I'll give you some examples that will give you the idea intuitively of this kind of utterance. Supposing that somebody is christening a ship and says, I name this ship the Queen Elizabeth, smashing the champagne bottle against the stem or failing to smash it and all the rest of it. Or suppose that somebody says, I apologize, or I beg your pardon. Or supposing again somebody says, I bid you welcome. Or again, somebody says, I advise you to do so and so, or I order you to do so and so. Now these are a few examples, but of course such utterances are extremely common. One place where they are found in a rather formal guise is in legal documents, legal instruments. In English, at any rate, we divide a legal instrument or document into two parts: the preamble, which states the facts of the situation, and what we call the operative clauses, the clauses of the instrument which serve to effect the legal transaction that we are performing. We say, in the first part of the document, I, John Jones, possess a certain house, and in the operative part of the document we say, I, John Jones, give or sell this house to John Smith. The second part is the operative clause and is precisely a performative utterance of our kind. Perfectly well known, you see, it's just that we've chosen to give it this very rebarbative name. Again, philosophers, for example, have been very interested in some things that are clearly performative. Vague, though the idea of performative is, these things are performative. If anything is, I promise to do so and so. Utterances in which promises are made are clearly performative utterances. For example, the promise that you make, the undertaking that you give in the course of marrying somebody. You say, I do take this woman to be my lawful wedded wife. I so and so do take this woman to be my lawful wedded wife. When I issue this utterance, I am not reporting on my marriage. I am indulging in it. I am marrying. Sometimes people ask, even at this stage, what's the proof that these utterances are not true or false? How can you demonstrate to us that they aren't the sort of utterance that is meant to be true or false? The answer to that is no proof or argument is needed. All that we're doing is pointing out something which is perfectly obvious and which, in a way, everybody, I suppose, is surreptitiously aware of. No proof is needed. Well, I have said that they aren't true or false, but let's be clear that we are not saying that they never imply things which are true or false. They very commonly and often do. For instance, if I say, I do take this woman to be my lawful wedded wife, I certainly imply, in one of the many senses of that word, I certainly imply that I am not already married. And that may be true or false. And if it's false, that's to say, if I am already married, then this utterance, I do take this woman to be my lawful wedded wife, is in trouble. However, the fact that these utterances can, and in fact practically always do, imply a great many things, the truth of or falsity of which is ascertainable, things which are true or false, that's not the same thing as to say that the utterance itself is true or false. When, to take one of the examples I've already given you, when somebody says, I apologize, what he does is to perform the act of apologizing. And to raise the question whether his utterance, I apologize, is true or false, is utterly nonsensical. Well now, this is the important thing. Although we've said that these performative utterances are not true or false, are not liable to be false in particular, they are nevertheless liable to go wrong in a number of ways which may be thought special to them. They're not exempt from all forms of criticism, far from it. For a performative utterance to be entirely successful and above criticism, it has to be, in general, issued in the right circumstances. If one or more of quite a number of different kinds of condition are not satisfied, then the performative utterance will be in trouble, and we shall say, for the sake of a word, it will be unhappy in various ways. And what I want to do next is to illustrate three of the most characteristic ways in which a performative utterance may be unhappy, fail to come off. Well, firstly, Now, performative utterance may, like any other ritual act or ceremony, be on occasion, as the lawyers say, void or without effect. If the utterer is not in a position to perform such an act, or if the object upon which he purports to perform it is not a fit and proper object for that particular act to be performed on, then merely by uttering the words concerned, by going through the ritual, he does not succeed in performing the act. His act is void, we may say, or another variant, he has merely gone through a form of performing the act, but he hasn't performed it. To go back to our other example, if I say the words at the marriage ceremony, I do take this woman to be my lawful wedded wife. As a matter of fact, I don't say those words, but for 15 years I've alleged that we do, and it's only recently somebody has pointed out to me that we don't. So let's stick to it. If we say the words, I do take this woman to be my lawful wedded wife, and if I am in fact already married with wife living undivorced and so on, then I do not succeed in performing the act of marrying at all, but only I've only gone through the form of marrying. Similarly, I cannot baptize penguins because penguins are not a fit and proper object for this form of exploitation. I cannot name a ship unless I am the person appointed to name her. If I've been appointed to name the ship the Queen Elizabeth, and I have the champagne bottle poised in my hand and I'm just about to wham it, when some low type comes up, snatches the bottle away, bangs it on the stem, shouts in a loud voice, I name this ship the Generalissimo, darling, and kicks away the chocks, and off she goes. If all this happens, however we choose to characterize the unfortunate sides of this affair, we shall all agree on one thing, that he has not succeeded in naming the ship the Generalissimo Stalin. It may not be worth dragging her back again and so on, but that's another matter. So there are several sub-varieties of ways in which our act may be void, because the object is wrong, I'm not the fit and proper person, and so on and so forth. In all these cases, the purported act fails to come off, is void. Now, a second way in which a performative utterance may go wrong is one where it is issued, as we say, insincerely. If, for example, I say, I promise to do so and so, when I haven't the remotest intention of doing it, or when I don't even think that it's possible for me practically to do it, then there is something radically wrong, and we say that the promise is hollow and the formula has been abused and the act was not done sincerely. Now, in this case, of course, the act is not void. However insincerely I promised, I have promised. But still, the formula has been used in a way, we may say, speaking anthropomorphically, quite contrary to the intention of those who invented it. Plainly, we may say, speaking anthropomorphically, such a formula as I promise to is intended only for use by persons who have intentions and beliefs consonant with that which they promise, and not with people holding opposite intentions. So, the formula, when used in this way, is abused. And we may call this a second way in which a performative utterance may be unhappy. Now, there's a third type of unhappiness also which arises. Let's grant that the performative utterance this time is issued in the right circumstances and not insincerely, quite sincerely, and therefore is not void. Then, commonly, we shall say that the utterance takes effect. By this we don't mean that any actual events are brought about as consequences of the issuing of the utterance. We mean that as a result of the act having been performed, certain events in the future, if they occur, will be in order, and certain other events in the future, if they occur, will be out of order. I mean, this is all very simple. Supposing that I say, I name this ship the Queen Elizabeth, and this is done successfully, then the christening takes effect, by which we mean that thereafter, if anyone does refer to the vessel as the Queen Elizabeth, his act will be in order, whereas if anyone refers to it, for example, as the Generalissimo Stalin, his act will be out of order. Once an utterance of this kind has taken effect, then for the future, certain events are in order, certain other events are out of order. A case of this would be, supposing I have made a promise. Then, of course, if in the future I carry out what I have promised, that is in order, and if I fail to carry it out, that is out of order. Now, if I fail to carry it out, we say that there is a breach of promise or a breach of commitment. A breach of commitment is when we do something which is out of order in view of this act successfully performed in the past. So then, similarly, if I say I bid you welcome and then proceed to behave boorishly and in a hostile manner towards you, plainly here I am breaching a commitment, not perhaps so clearly defined a one, but still one which is genuinely existent. In general, with any performative utterance, if it is successfully issued, then for the future we will be committed in a number of ways, more or less definite and more or less stringent ways, to acting in one or another way rather than in yet other ways. Every performative utterance commits us for the future. So one kind of unhappiness then, the third kind, that arises in connection with performatives is when, a performative utterance having taken effect, there is subsequently a breach of some commitment. Those then are three unhappinesses I want to draw your attention to. Just in parenthesis, let me say that of course there are other things that can be wrong with a performative utterance, but since they're not specific to it, we won't pay any attention to them. I mean simply as being the performance of an action, the issuing of a performative utterance is liable to such troubles as that it was done under duress or by mistake and so on. And simply as being the issuing of an utterance, it is liable to a lot of troubles that affect any utterance simply as such as being misunderstood or in some certain ways nonsensical and so on. But we're not interested in these troubles that, of course, affect the performative, but only in the sort of special unhappinesses that I've mentioned. Having this somewhat vague idea, then, of the performative, it's rather natural to hope that we should be able to find some grammatical or lexical criterion, some criterion of verbal form, which would enable us to decide whether any given utterance is a performative one or not. But I'm afraid that hope proves largely vain. There are, it is true, two forms of utterance which we may describe as standard or normal forms of the performative utterance. Oddly enough, both of them forms of utterance which have been mistaken traditionally by grammarians at least for statemental forms. One of these two forms is the one that I've used in all the examples I've given hitherto. That's to say, it begins with a verb in the first person singular, present, indicative, active, occupying this prominent position at the head of the sentence. I promise that, I apologize, I advise you to, I order you to, and so on. And the other standard form, as we're calling it, it's rather high-flown title. The other standard form is simply a passive variant of that one. Here we put the verb in the second or third person of the present indicative of the passive voice and say something like this: you are hereby warned that this animal is dangerous, or passengers are hereby warned to cross the railway tracks only by the bridge, this kind of thing. And both these forms of expression can, in certain cases, be not performative but constative. Even when the verb used is one like promise or warn, which is a verb usually used in a performative way. But there are certain tests for establishing that an utterance taking one of these two convenient forms is performative. For example, if you take the passive variant, the second one, then it plainly is in fact performative if you can insert in English this little word hereby. If you can put in hereby, then it's made quite plain that the utterance is a performative one. However, actually I think it's the active standard form which is the more useful. By playing about with it, we hope to get a list of all the verbs that are used in this performative way. I suppose there may be some 8,000 of them. All such verbs exhibit a certain asymmetry between their use in the first person singular of the present indicative active, that's the tense we're interested in, and their use in other persons and other tenses. I mean the asymmetry that we find between I promise on the one hand and he promises, or I promised, I promised, on the other. If we use he promises or I promised, I promised, then certainly the verb is used descriptively or declaratively or for making a statement. To stop saying all these variant things each time, I'll say for short, it is used constatively. When I say he promises, I do describe his doing something on a past occasion, namely his using the first person singular I promise. But when we ourselves use the expression I promise, we do not describe our own on some occasion using of the expression I promise. On the contrary, we obviously perform an act of promising, not one of describing. Well, this kind of asymmetry between this part of the verb and all the rest is typical of performative verbs. Of course, you can only detect it by a kind of grammarian's or philologist's intuition, but it's not very difficult. And by means of observing this asymmetry, we try to make a list of all such verbs, and hence, of course, of all the kinds of act that can be performed by the issuing of performative utterances, because obviously each one of these verbs serves not only for the performing of the act concerned, but also as the name of the act performed. Promise is used in the ritual of promising, and it also gives us the name of the act performed, viz. Promising. But in spite of all these this interesting stuff about certain normal ways, very explicit ways, as we call them, of expressing a performative utterance, we have to admit right away that utterances may be performative when they exhibit none of these characteristics at all. If, for example, I order you to shut the door is a performative utterance, as we said, is in fact, to issue it, is in fact to perform the act of ordering you to shut the door. Well, if that's so, then to say merely shut the door is quite plainly also to perform the very same act, or what may be the same act, the act of ordering you to shut the door. Therefore, shut the door is a performative utterance just as much as I order you to shut the door. And taking it a bit further still, supposing I write up on a placard in a field, on a board in a field, simply the one word, bull, plainly, that is every bit as much the issuing of a performative utterance, here of course in written or inscriptional form, every bit as much the issuing of a performative utterance as it would have been if I'd written on the board, passers-by are hereby warned that this bull is dangerous. To write up bull on that board is to perform the act of warning people about the bull. We should be quite wrong if we took that bull on the board to be a description of the local fauna, as the notice kangaroo on the cage of an animal in the zoo is a description of the local fauna, is a constative utterance, bull is not. So, we have to agree that in order to make our utterance performative, it isn't necessary to use the explicit devices that occur in our preferred standard forms. Indeed, any utterance at all is apt to be made into the issuing of a warning or a threat or an order simply by our issuing it in a certain tone of voice or accompanying it by a certain gesture or even more simply still, simply by virtue of the circumstances in which it was issued being what they are. We say something like this, coming from him in those circumstances, I was bound to take what he said as an order. Although in other circumstances, of course, it might have been a simple statement. So, we can't say that to be a performative, an utterance has to take one of these explicit forms. The most we can say is that the explicit performative formula, as we call it, such as I promise to, and so on, serves to make both explicit and precise what act it is that we are performing in issuing our utterance. Any more primitive form of expression, although it is equally performative, will be vaguer. Not necessarily in a derogative sense, but still vaguer. For example, if I say merely, I shall be there tomorrow, it is left uncertain whether in so speaking I am making a promise, or expressing an intention, or making a forecast of what my own behavior is likely to be. These are three different possibilities, and there are others. If I say shut the door merely, it is uncertain whether I am ordering you, or entreating you, or urging you, or what not. Only the explicit performative formula can clear this up and make precise what it is we are doing. It is a probable conjecture that these explicit performative formulae are evolved in the course of the evolution of any language, going hand in hand with the evolution of more complex forms of society. The more complex the form of society, the more different forms of juristic and other act will need to be carefully and precisely distinguished and defined, and this demands the invention of explicit performative formulae. I'll just put in one warning. Although the explicit performative formula, such as I promise to or I order you to, makes explicit what act it is we are performing by speaking as we do, that's not the same thing as to say that it states or describes what act it is that we are doing. If it, of course, did the latter, then the whole utterance would be true or false, which we've seen it isn't. Even in ceremonies or rituals that are not verbal at all, we have devices which in just the same way make explicit what act is being performed. For example, supposing I appear before you and bow deeply from the waist. It may be quite uncertain what I am doing. I may be simply bending down to observe the flowers or to tie my shoelace. But it's possible that what I am doing is some form of obeisance to you, some form of homage. Now, in order to clear up this unfortunate kind of ambiguity, we usually invent some little device such as raising our hat or saying salam with which to accompany the bow and by means of which to make explicit and unambiguous, make our act explicitly and unambiguously one of doing obeisance or homage. Nobody would wish to say, however, that raising your hat describes what you are doing. It merely makes it, constitutes it explicitly an act of homage. And so, putting I promise that at the head of the performative utterance makes explicit what act you are doing, and eo ipso does the act, but it does not describe it. Well, we can't in fact therefore give any single grammatical criterion or any criterion of form for detecting the performative utterance, but we can hope to arrive at a list of all these explicit performative verbs and therefore of the things of this kind that we can do. It's not an impossibly long task. The number of these verbs, for instance, that we've got to detect and classify is considerably less than the number of beetles that entomologists have classified. Well, now all this time, that will do as an introduction of the performative utterance. And if you're prepared to hear any more, I should now like to cast some doubt on something that we have been rather taking for granted all this time. We've been rather taking for granted that there is a clear contrast between our performative utterance and the constative utterance or statement. We've been rather taking the statement for granted, simply because it's familiar, and introducing our performative by way of contrast with it. This is a thing that often happens historically. But if we now look back a bit, it may be that we shall find that the constative utterance, typified by the statement, itself exhibits many of the characteristics that we have been blithely announcing as peculiar to the performative. You see, it is characteristic of what's been happening lately in philosophy that the statement has been found to be liable to a number of other ills besides the traditional ill of being false. It's always been said, well, a statement can be in trouble through being false. But latterly, it's been found that statements are subject to other troubles. A statement may be, as people are perhaps over fond of saying, nonsensical in one or another of several more or less simple ways which are gradually being discriminated. Now I want to consider three special ways in which a statement can go wrong, other than the way of being false, and to point out that these three ways in which the statement, important ways in which the statement has been shown to be able to go wrong, are pretty like the very three ways in which I claimed before the performative was liable to be unhappy. Two of these ways of going wrong have only recently been discovered. The third one has of course been known for a very long time. I'll tell you what they are. The first way in which a statement can go wrong is of these three ways is the way is the thing that happens when something like this is said. All Jack's children are bald, but Jack has no children. Or perhaps an alternative version, somebody says all Jack's children are bald when, as a matter of fact, Jack has no children. Now, there's been a lot of bother about this particular kind of affair. But at any rate, it seems agreed that all Jack's children are bald, but Jack has no children. Or all Jack's children are bald, said when Jack has no children. It seems agreed that these are not false. There is something radically wrong with them, but they're not false. Similarly, the second case invented by Moore, somebody says the cat is on the mat, but, or and, although, I do not believe that it is. Here again, there's something wrong. It isn't that the sentence is false as a whole, necessarily. It's perfectly possible for the cat to be on the mat when a certain person doesn't believe it, but there is something wrong about saying the cat is on the mat and I do not believe it is. The third example that I'll give is, of course, a very old kind of thing. When somebody, as we say, contradicts themselves, somebody says, all men blush and some men do not blush. Or someone says, all men blush and then subsequently says, some men do not blush. Now, in each of these three types of case concerned with the statements, there's a feeling of outrage. And very often people feel so outraged that they don't even distinguish between the three. They say they're all, each of them, nonsense, or each of them contradictory, or in each case we say something contrary to what we've already implied. But in point of fact, they are just three different disasters. We say there are more ways of killing a cat than drowning it in butter. And so there are more ways of fundamentally outraging speech, even constative speech, than merely by, say, contradicting oneself. What it's common to say now is, by way of a label, to take the first case, it's common to say that Jack's children are bald, or all Jack's children are bald, presupposes that Jack has some children. Presupposes, any statement it said presupposes the existence of the things referred to in it. That's put rather roughly. In the case of the cat is on the mat, for the sake of a word, it's commonly said nowadays that when you say anything of a statemental kind, such as the cat is on the mat, then your saying it implies that you, the speaker, believe it to be so. This is a rather special sense of imply. We are restricting it for the present discussion just to this particular case. Of course, notoriously, imply is used in many different ways. But there is this special sense of imply in which when you make any statement, your making the statement implies that you believe it. Then, so we'll use implies for that and presupposes for the Jack's children case. And then in the last case, we shall say, this is the familiar traditional one, that all men blush entails, it is not the case that some men do not blush. Entailment, in this familiar kind of example, is a matter of the consistency and inconsistency of propositions that you utter. Quite different from the cat is on the mat and I do not believe the cat is on the mat, which are perfectly consistent with each other. The trouble there is nothing to do with consistency. It is to do with going contrary to the implications of your uttering the first part of the sentence. Well, I could spend more time, but I won't bore you with showing in detail that these three ways of going wrong, characteristic of statements, are different from each other. I shall just take it that you will understand, probably knew before I spoke at all, that they are different. Now, I should like to compare these three ways in which a statement goes wrong, seriatim, with the three ways that I mentioned to you in which a performative utterance typically goes wrong. All Jack's children are bald, but or and Jack has no children, can be compared with, I give you my watch, but, or and, I have no watch. All Jack's children are bald, said when Jack has in fact no children, is comparable to, I give you my watch, said when I have as a matter of fact no watch. We should say that a performative utterance presupposes the existence of the items referred to in it in, I think, precisely the same way as the statement has been found to presuppose the existence of the things referred to in it. And we should say, I consider that the statement made referring to things which don't exist is in exactly the same position as the performative utterance, the one about the watch, made referring to things that don't exist. And just as lawyers say that the gift of the watch when I have no watch is void for want of reference, so I think we might well say in the case of the statement that the statement about Jack's children is void for want of reference. I don't think there's any difficulty in seeing that in this case the presuppositional difficulty, far trouble found to infect statements, is identical with one of the unhappinesses characteristic of performatives. Well, I don't think there's any difficulty either in seeing that the same is true in the second case. Just as my saying the cat is on the mat implies that I believe it's on the mat, so my saying that I promise to be there tomorrow implies that I intend to be there tomorrow. The procedure of asserting or stating is designed for use, using that anthropomorphic expression, is designed for use by persons holding certain beliefs. Procedure of promising for use by persons having certain intentions and holding certain beliefs. If we don't hold beliefs or have intentions consonant with the content of our utterance, then there is, in exactly the same way in either case, insincerity and abuse of procedure. If we actually announce that we do not have the requisite beliefs or intentions in the very same breath as we purport to assert or purport to promise, then there is a kind of self-stultification which gives rise to our feeling of outrage. The feeling of outrage in the cat is on the mat and I do not believe it is to my mind identical with the feeling of outrage when somebody says, I promise to be there tomorrow and I have no intention of being there tomorrow. There is the same kind of self-stultification in each case. Even in the third case, on which I shall spend less long, I think that the trouble infecting statements here, self-contradiction, is strictly the same, at any rate strictly analogous to one of the troubles infecting performatives. We may regard the assertion, such as all men blush, as committing us, once made, for the future, in more or less stringent ways, to certain behavior, more particularly and obviously to certain behavior with respect to future utterances. If, having said all men blush, I subsequently make assertions inconsistent with this one, contradictory of it, then there is a breach of commitment at least comparable to that which occurs when, having said I promise to do so and so, I subsequently do not perform the thing or do something different. It seems to me that self-contradiction is simply one case, which has deservedly been specially studied, of breach of commitment. Well, if there's anything in all this, it begins to appear that constative utterances are as much liable to unhappinesses, and to pretty much the same unhappinesses, as are performative utterances. And indeed, we might go further. We might use the clue provided by the unhappinesses detected in the case of the performative as a tool for discovering yet more unhappinesses that can occur with statements, unhappinesses hitherto perhaps unnoticed. And I think this actually can be done. You remember that one very common way for a performative utterance to be void was when the person issuing it was not in a position to, or lacked the necessary status for, performing the act concerned. For example, it's no good my saying, I order you to do something, if I am not in a position to order you to. If, for example, I lack the necessary authority, the consequence is merely that my purported act of ordering is void or null. Well now, doesn't something of the same kind occur over the issuing of constative utterances, statements? I know it is a general impression that in the constative field, we, that is you or I or any fool, can just go round stating anything we like about anything. There's no need to be in a position to state it. Why not just state it? You don't have to have any special status for stating things. Of course, you may incur a considerable risk of stating something false in cases where you're ill-informed or ill-equipped, but what of that? You can still state it. I think this impression derived from logical and so on theories is quite misleading. In real life, and using the word state as we actually use it, there are lots and lots and lots of things about which I can state absolutely nothing, because I am not in any position to make any statement about them. And this may be so for more than one reason. For example, I cannot now state how many persons there are in the next room. I haven't looked, I have no information on the subject. So I can't state it, I'm not in a position to. Ha! But you say, what if I do in fact say? As indeed, I can. There are 50 persons in the next room at this moment. Or I state there are 50 persons in the room in the next room at this moment. Haven't I then, contrary to your theory, succeeded in stating how many persons there are in the next room? Very likely falsely, of course, of course, of course, of course. Well, I think this is just fatuous. I might allow, if you were to say, there are 50 people in the next room at this moment, I might allow that you were guessing. You guessed that there were 50 people in the next room, but I know perfectly well you can't state. Now, if you actually use the expression, I state there are 50 people in the next room, when you and I and everyone knows you haven't the least idea or means of knowing how many there are, what are we to do? Well, the position is exactly like the position when one person, A, says to another person, B, I order you to do so-and-so. Supposing it's a private soldier who goes up to his general and says, I order you to sound the retreat. Now somebody says, has he ordered him to sound the retreat or has he not? Obviously, there's no simple answer to the question. He has used the formula, I order you to retreat, undoubtedly. On the other hand, since he has absolutely no authority over the general, but quite the reverse, since he is not in a position to order him at all, we should say his act is void. He's gone through a form of ordering his general to retreat, but, of course, he hasn't ordered him to because he hasn't the authority. Well, that's rather oversimplifying this story about ordering. I'm taking order as rather a more formal word than in fact it is, but still it'll do us a rough parallel. So, similarly, if somebody says about the next room, I state that there are 50 people in the next room, blandly, although we all know that he hasn't the remotest means of knowing, of course he has been through a form of stating that there are 50 people in the next room, but we all know he isn't in any position to state anything about it. Supposing this occurs, I talk to you and say, I'm feeling rather mouldy this morning. And you say, you aren't. And I say, how do you mean I'm not? What right have you to say what my feelings are? And I say, what do you mean, right? I'm just stating what your feelings are, that's all. Of course, I may be wrong, I'm not dogmatic about it, but what of that? Surely I can make a simple statement, can't I? No, obviously I cannot. I cannot, in ordinary circumstances, unless, for example, you've told me what your feelings are, I cannot state what your feelings are any more than I can state what horse will win the race. I can guess what horse will win the race, or forecast, or conjecture, or whatnot, but I cannot state it, because the thing's in the future and hasn't been won. There are countless things, then, that I can't state, because I'm not in a position to state them. So, I think this not unimportant phenomenon concerning stating can be said to have been unearthed simply by adopting the hypothesis that statements exhibit all the infirmities that performatives do. Well, now, there's one more thing, however, that still appears to constitute a radical difference between the performative and the statement or constative utterance. The statement still, after all, has left to it one peculiarity. It alone can be, we've apparently admitted, true or false. Well, I think that this distinction, too, is eliminable. On the other hand, I wonder whether I'm going to eliminate it now, because I think I've gone on just about long enough. Let me cut it short, and if you have no questions to ask and so on, then later on I might resume about it if you like, but I'll say very shortly what I have to say on this point. We may consider, firstly, whether the performative utterance is not in fact liable to certain forms of appraisal which are at least very like appraisal in terms of truth and falsity, and are at any rate very unlike the troubles that we've been calling unhappinesses. Generally speaking, what I should say is this kind of thing. Supposing we take some performative utterance such as, I advise you to do so and so, or I warn you to do so and so, something like this. Then, besides all the questions about it that we have hitherto raised, as to whether the act was successfully performed and sincerely performed and so forth, there is also the little question whether the advice was good and justified advice, whether the warning was a justified warning, whether such and such another performative utterance was sound or fair and the like. So with very many at least of our performative utterances, we seem to assess them, appraise them in what I shall call a second dimension, a dimension in which we compare the utterance issued with certain facts. Generally, I think, facts obtaining at the time of the issuing of the utterance, but sometimes, additionally, facts that occurred subsequent to the issuing of the utterance. Both of these sorts of facts are invoked when we consider whether the utterance, admittedly a performative one, was fair or sound or justifiable or right or correct and so forth. We don't admittedly use the word true, but we do use a good many labels of appraisal which have to do with in some way with the confrontation of the performative utterance with facts. Which is enough to make it plausible that this kind of appraisal is something like the appraisal that we use in the case of statements when we confront them with facts, if we're still allowed to say this in our old-fashioned way, in deciding whether they're true or false. Now, on the other hand, is it so certain that the statement or constative utterance is being correctly said to be always true or false? Isn't it the case that when we appraise even the statement or constative utterance in the manner of confronting it with the facts, isn't it really the case that we employ for such appraisal really a vast number of terms Only very occasionally the simple little black and white terms, true and false, and that this considerable array of terms of appraisal overlaps to a great extent with the terms of appraisal that we use in respect of the performative when assessing it in what I've called this second dimension. If we return from the logic books to real life, we find that things which must undoubtedly be called statements are very seldom describable as just true or just false, very often not describable as true or false at all, and yet they're undoubtedly statements. And this will mean, you see, that the little speciality which was to discriminate statements from performative utterance collapses. In fact, we find that we are using a very similar large array of labels of appraisal in comparing both forms of utterance with fact. I'll give one or two examples of things that are undoubtedly statements which cannot be said to be true or false. One is this example, France is hexagonal. Another is, Lord Raglan won the Battle of Alma. There are many others. Supposing somebody were to say, well now, I wonder if it's true that Lord Raglan won the Battle of Alma or that France is hexagonal. We realize, of course, from the very start, not merely, of course, that the utterance is in some way to be confronted with the facts, but also that there isn't going to be any answer of the true or false form. Supposing we confront Francis Hexagonal with the facts, I suppose, with France. Is it true or is it not? Well, if you like, up to a point. Of course, I can see what you mean for certain intents and purposes, certainly. Good enough for a top-ranking general, perhaps, but not for a geographer. Naturally, it's pretty rough. We should say pretty rough and pretty good as a pretty rough statement. But then one says, but is it true or is it false? I don't mind whether it's rough. Of course it's rough. But it has to be true or false, the statement, isn't it? Well, but how can one answer the question whether it's true or false that France is hexagonal? It's just rough. And that is the right and final answer to the question of the relationship of France is hexagonal to France. It is a rough description. It isn't a true one or a false one. And so with Lord Raglan and the Battle of Alma. Alma, in case you didn't know, why should you, was what we call a soldier's battle, if ever there was one. Well, of course, Lord Raglan was in command. Ordinarily, he was in command of the British, though not of the French, and the French were supposed to do what the British indicated they would like them to do, and to a minor extent possibly did so. Happens to be true that none of Lord Raglan's orders were ever transmitted. Well, did he win the Battle of Alma? Not, of course, in some context. It's perfectly justifiable to say so. Something of an exaggeration, maybe. Of course, if any question of giving the old fool a medal for it, that's rather a different matter. One wouldn't want to dwell on his having won the battle in that case. Really, the fact is this. When we talk of true and false, we haven't got, what people too readily suppose, a couple of labels for two simple contradictory properties, one of which every statement possesses. We have rather a very abstract label for a whole dimension of assessment of these utterances, exactly as we have in the case of the performative. If we really go into the matter of the relation of statements to facts, and if we do not restrict ourselves, as people too often do, to assertions which are idiotically simple or ideally simple, then we soon find that we cannot disentangle some simple truth and simple falsity from considerations of what is fair or equitable or exaggerated or precise or general or rough and the like. Well, I'll stop at this point simply saying that we find we have to think again about this alleged contrast between performative and constative. And the result, I think, of further reflection on the matter would be that we don't want to divide utterances into two classes, the effect of which is to give stating a peculiar, isolated preeminence, which it doesn't really deserve. What we want to realize is that when I issue an utterance, there is always the question what speech act I was performing in issuing it. One of such possible speech acts is, for example, stating, which is only one of a family of cognate speech acts, including describing, reporting, and so forth, which are not all the same. But this whole family, callable by the name of constating, is itself only one of a vast array of further families, in and among which will be found such acts as warning, threatening, ordering, advising, even apologizing, all the kinds of act which we said were typically performed when a performative utterance was issued. Stating, we discover, is only one in a huge array of possible speech acts, in a certain sense of that expanded term, among which warning, threatening, and so on occur. What we don't want any longer a division of utterances into two. What we want instead is something much more difficult to get, a classification by families and with criteria of all the possible kinds of speech act, in this sense the speech act, that we perform in issuing utterances.